week of September 9th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 423, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Oz, I'm Michael Giltz.
In Oz, the Wizard of, or Oz as in Australia?
I'd take either, but I was thinking of the Wizard of Oz because I wanted to clarify those shoes that were found. Let's just be clear. There were like seven pairs of shoes created for the Wizard of Oz.
You mean the ruby slippers? We should say we mentioned this on last week's show.
Absolutely. The whole world mentioned it. Okay. The ruby slippers, there were about seven pairs created. I think from what I hear that the pair that was stolen out of that museum in the town was one of the test color pairs where they created a pair of shoes to see how it would look on screen. I don't think it was even one of the four pairs that she wore. In the movie or had as a standby. So it was really well down the list in terms of the ruby slippers, and we wanted to make sure. I think we had mentioned before, you know, multiple pairs. This wasn't one of the big pairs. This wasn't like pairs that were nestled on the feet of Judy Garland. So, you know.
Well, I know last week we also talked about the U.S. Open, the tennis tournament, which, you know what? Who knew a tennis tournament, there was actually drama. So it actually kind of fell right into your entertainment coverage.
My entertainment sports coverage, absolutely. My mom is a tennis umpire, or has been, was, I should say. She's 89 years old. God bless her. Tennis umpire, worked all over the world. My brother was also a tennis umpire. I was a ball kid, so I know tennis, and I love tennis. The women's final was a disaster. The umpire did absolutely nothing wrong, technically. But when you're talking about an umpire for any sporting event, football, baseball, basketball, tennis, if you're talking about the umpire, something has gone wrong. You know, something has gone wrong because you don't want to talk about the umpire. You do not want to interject yourself into a game if you can avoid it. Ramos did nothing wrong by the book. There's nothing to reprimand him for by the book, but we're talking about him and that ain't good. And if he had made different choices that he had the discretion to do, we wouldn't be talking about him at all, which is the way it should have been. So it's a real mess and it's a shame.
And this is the women's final that we're talking about.
This is the women's final with Serena Williams. I think many people will be familiar with it. It was called The Mother of All Meltdowns by the New York Post, which I thought was funny. But yeah, it was a disastrous women's final. You know, penalties imposed by the chair umpire ultimately created havoc in the game. Serena made charges of sexism. If you look at the women's versus men's, I think that's a fair challenge. The Women's Tennis Association, the USTA, Billie Jean King, Chrissy Everett on air, all sorts of tennis pros have come forward to say she's right. Women are treated differently than men. Men lose their temper, yell things, get angry, and they're seen as passionate. When women do it, they're like, oh, no, you're not getting out of hand here, sister. And nobody's even mentioned race, the fact that she's a black woman who was getting angry and upset, and how they are treated differently all throughout their lives, even during her pregnancy and her birth delivery. But anyway, the main thing to say is coaching. Coaching in tennis in the Grand Slams is unusual. Unlike almost any other sport, there's no coach. They can't come to you during the match. They can't give you pointers during the break and talk to you. There's no coaching. When you go out to play a Grand Slam event, you're on your own. There's almost no other sport where that's the case. It's really unusual. Football, baseball, basketball,
ice skating,
diving,
ice skating.
There's coaches on the side talking to them as they go out. So every round, you know, like there's a coach right there who can caution them and kill them. And between the short round and the long round, there's a coach right there kneading their shoulders, telling them, make sure you stick the landing. Whatever. It's very unusual. It's one of the things I think is cool about tennis. The fact in the Grand Slams, no coaching. However, coaches sit in the stands, and it is rampantly obvious that coaches make signals, give encouragement, make pointers, move forward, charge the net. You know, they're doing things and making signals all the time. It's almost impossible to, you know, control officiate, because if you touch your nose or tug on your ear, is that a signal? How can the chair umpire know? So it's happening constantly, but it's almost never penalized by a chair umpire. In fact, in the entire U.S. Open this year, two or three women received penalties because of coaching from the sidelines throughout all the hundreds of matches that took place. No men. It's almost never enforced. In the final, the chair umpire imposed a penalty for coaching from the sidelines. And in fact, what makes that especially ironic, we're going on way too long here, I know, but Serena doesn't like coaching. She's really good on her own. She doesn't need it. Most of her career, it wasn't even an option at any level. But nowadays, in other tournaments, you can have your coach come. You can say, I want to talk to my coach for a number of points during the match, and they can come to you during a break and talk to you. She never does it. She doesn't want it. She doesn't need it. So to accuse her of accepting coaching when she never even wants it in the first place is especially ironic and a shame. And that was what created the domino effect to where we ended up with her being penalized a game and being very upset and feeling she was treated differently because she's a woman. And frankly, as I would say, a black woman. And it's a disaster and it's awful. And I think, while I don't like coaching, I don't want them on the field, they should institute a new rule and just say, look, ignore whatever they do on the side. Unless they speak verbally and start to yell out instructions, you know, you can't penalize that. Just drop that. Because it's a farce. They almost never do. And that was what created the big problem.
And I'm sure you can catch all of this on YouTube.
Oh, of course. It's everywhere. Absolutely. Yeah. What you can also catch on YouTube is edited clips of men losing their SHR, you know, losing their mind in anger and frustration and not getting a penalty.
Yeah, you know what I love was John McEnroe's comment where he said, I don't understand what the big deal is.
Meaning about why she was penalized.
No, I'm joking, of course, because of course, if there is anybody who lost his temper the most, it was, Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe.
But he received many penalties and points and warnings and things during his career. But absolutely, sometimes when a player is like that, you're scared of him and you're afraid to give him a penalty. Other times, they're a troublemaker. And as an umpire, you want to lay down the law early and make sure they know you're not going to allow any fuss. It's like a judge in a courtroom. And Ramos, the judge on this, is known for being a stickler for the rules and knowing for laying down the law and saying, no nonsense here. So he didn't have a long history with Serena. He gave Venus a penalty once in a match with her years ago. They're already not happy to see him. So it was a big, ugly mess. And like I was saying, online, you can see clips of men losing their mind. You can see women getting penalized for much less.
Well, I know that this show is not a sports show at all. But, we talk about the Super Bowl sometimes.
I was going to talk about the Yankee trip, but I guess we should talk about what's going to be on this week's show.
Wait, the Yankees traded some? What do you, after the show. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we pat ourselves on the back for correctly predicting the newly proposed Oscar for popular film would not happen anytime soon. I guess it wasn't popular. Indeed, after Universal catcalls, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences said, sheesh, there's no pleasing you people. In other words, they'll study the issue further. Yeah. Okay, it's never going to happen. In China news, Jack Ma is stepping down from Alibaba, and Wanda is looking to offload some of its investment in AMC. Meanwhile, MoviePass is so broke, it made absolutely no news at all. No news this week. Come on, guys, get on the ball. In book filter news, we're recommending a book hot off the presses. I mean, this is like sizzling. Yeah, it's from 75 years ago, okay? On Inside Baseball, we focus in on sexual misconduct. Les Moonves is out at CBS. It seemed inevitable, but with six more women coming forward over the weekend, now the question is, how much will Moonves get? But not how much he'll get, but how much money can CBS pay him to go away and avoid a drawn-out lawsuit without angering activists? This is going to be followed, I think, quite extensively over the next several months. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Variety and Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo. And when we cover worldwide box office, that means we're talking about movies from Germany and Spain and China and Korea and Mexico. And Romania is the hot new country. It's not a Romanian film, but The Nun is the number one film in the world. It's part of the Conjuring franchise. It's set in Romania in the early 1950s and is about how this crazy nun's origin story. $131 million worldwide. That's for a movie that cost about $22 million. It means this Conjuring franchise, once this movie is all said and done, they're looking at $1.5 billion in total worldwide box office. That's a fair early estimate. They're already at $1.25 billion, and this movie is just taken off. It's a monster. Unlike the other films in the Conjuring franchise, it's not that well reviewed because for horror films, they've maintained pretty good quality. This one, not so much, but I'm sure we will see The Priest, The Monk, and anything else they can come up with down the road. At number two around the world is Mission Impossible Fallout, the Tom Cruise film, $42 million on the weekend. $726 million worldwide, still going strong. And now that it's passed the last two movies, both of which were at just about $700 million, this is Tom Cruise's top grossing film, not just in the Mission Impossible franchise, but of all time.
Wow. I did not Sperling. Know that. I did not.
Waiting for you, Sperling.
Oh, wait. I can't believe I missed my cue. I feel like Matthew McConaughey, right? And somebody asked me, hey, how's it going? Are you okay? And, you know, I could say, I'm all right. But instead, you asked me, you softballed me this, and I should have said, wait, it's Tom Cruise's top film of all time. Is that true? Adjusted for inflation?
And the answer, of course, is no, but it's close. Top Gun is the film that looks most likely to be his top grossing film of all time. Adjusted for inflation, that movie made $780 million worldwide. So it's not there yet, but I'm almost certain Mission Impossible Fallout will pass that. So even adjusted for inflation, this will be his big film. This is the one. And this emphasizes the point. He's never had a big fat franchise that makes $800, $900, $1 billion, not like Harrison Ford did back in the day, relatively speaking. So it's a big, big movie for Tom Cruise. At number three around the world is Crazy Rich Asians, another $19 million on the weekend, $165 million worldwide. Right below that is The Meg, the giant shark movie. That made $17 million, and by the end of next weekend, it will have passed $500 million, $500 million worldwide.
Can I just point something out really quickly here? Crazy Rich Asians in North America made $136.2 million so far, okay? The Meg made $131.5 million so far. Now, Crazy Rich Asians... Okay, so they're pretty much on par with one another, box office-wise.
Well, not really, because The Meg cost $150 million to make.
Exactly.
And Crazy Rich Asians was groundbreaking and innovative and a real roll of the dice. Giant shark movies or animals attacking is not a new thing. It's been done 1,000 times in 1,000 different ways, from Jaws to Orca to Jurassic Park to, you know, rampaging animals is not a new thing.
Well,
it didn't get good reviews.
Here's where I was trying to go. $30 million, Crazy Rich Asians. Okay, so not only all the stuff that you mentioned about Crazy Rich Asians, okay, $30 million. That movie made its money back in the United States, okay? I don't know how many other territories it has to open in. The Meg, $150 million budget, as you pointed out, it's made close to $500 million worldwide so far.
Well, yeah, but Crazy Rich Asians has a lot more territories to go. So we'll have to see if it pulls it up from Asian territories. It doesn't even have a Chinese release date yet. And they're saying maybe the government won't want to show it because it shows such, you know, massive wealthy people living it up in an obscene manner, you know, having a bachelor party on a, what was it, a giant, like a container ship or something. I mean, it's just crazy. But what's also in common for those two films and The Nun is that they're all from Warner Brothers.
Yes.
And that points out the fact that Warner Brothers in North America has had the number one and the number two movie for 4 weeks in a row. The top two films have been Warner Brothers for the last month. And it's the first time that has happened in 25 years for any studio at all in North America. So after a very poor summer, they're having a very good August, September. Back to the charts. At number five is a new opening in North America. It's Peppermint, which sounds sweet, but it's in fact a thriller about a vigilante mom starring Jennifer Garner. $14 million on the weekend and poor reviews. And number six is John Cho's film Searching. $12 million on the weekend. $32 million worldwide, including about $5 million in Korea. So they're really happy to see that. And it's cool to see this film also capitalizing on Crazy Rich Asians and those films showing, hey, make a decent movie with a diverse cast. You're going to reach a diverse audience. And that means more money in the bank. And number seven is Alpha, the prehistoric boy and his dog movie. That's at $60 million worldwide. Right below that is Ant-Man and the Wasp, which passed the $600 million mark last weekend and is still pulling in some coin. And now Denzel Washington, proving he's a star. At number nine is The Equalizer 2. First, I thought it was definite this movie would be profitable. Then I said I wasn't so sure. But what you got to do is wait. Wait for the money to come in. And that's where we're at. $173 million worldwide. It's at $7 million this weekend alone. And so it's tripled its budget. It will by the end of next weekend for certain. It's tripled its budget. And that means this movie is pretty much a hit right out of the gate. We know it's going to have a long life in DVD and streaming and on demand and selling to cable and TV. There may be an Equalizer 3.
You know, I think that Alpha will also have a long life in ancillary markets. It's gotten great reviews. Everybody I know who's seen it really likes it. I think it's just one of those films that did not get good at marketing campaign behind it.
Yeah, it's very hard. You know, Sony, it's very hard to sell a movie. But they did it with The Equalizer 2, but maybe they dropped the ball with Alpha. Certainly, it's a hard sell. It's not an easy, obvious film to market to people. But below that is one that is. It's a sequel, The Incredibles 2. Another $7 million on the weekend, $1.1 billion worldwide. And good news for Sony right below that. At number 11 is the Adam Sandler film, Hotel Transylvania 3, Summer Vacation. $6 million on the weekend. That's about to pass the $500 million mark as well. So that movie's done great for him. And before you think, yeah, you know, thank God he's got animated films. Adam Sandler's been a big flop in live action movies. No. Not true. He's had two solid hits in the last 5 years, Blended with Drew Barrymore and the sequel Grown Ups 2. So the idea that Adam Sandler was in some horrible slump when Netflix picked him up and said, let's make movies with him, not true.
Well, he might have been in a horrible critical slump, not a financial one, that's for sure.
Well, he's usually in a horrible critical slump.
Yeah.
The movies where he gets good reviews are few and far between. They've happened, and I've liked them, but that's not his career modus operandi. And number 12 is Mamma Mia. Here we go again. Meryl Streep appears in that movie, even though I think she was supposed to have died at some point. But we get to see her in the movie, and we saw her at the U.S. Open. She's trending on Twitter as a meme because her reactions during the men's finals were so hilarious. It's funny because I glanced at the TV and said, oh, my God, Meryl Streep, that was the awesomest reaction shot I've ever seen. And apparently everybody screenshot that and put it on Twitter because, like, her whole match, she was so into it and so focused. There's literally like 17 images of Meryl Streep online freaking out over the men's final. It's very fun. But her movie, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, making money, not even close to the original, but it has made $375 million worldwide. Spike Lee continues to do very well. At number 13 is Black Klansman, a lucky number for him this time, $65 million worldwide. Right below that is Disney's Christopher Robin, another $6 million worldwide. It's at $140 million. So now they've doubled their budget. They're slowly making this movie not a bad flop, but a movie that's just underwhelming, disappointing. You don't get good reviews. It's a little too expensive. It's not surprising that they wouldn't do that well. But family fare with the Disney name, they're going to eke out, you know, they're going to be okay. Scrolling down, looking for something new to talk about. This looks like another film released in China. It's Pele, Birth of a Legend. It's a U.S. film, I believe. That's what we're talking about, from 2016. It's a fictional movie about the life of Pele. Horrible reviews, but apparently they just released it in China, I think. $2.5 million on the weekend, and that means it's at $5.7 million worldwide. And since it's a 2016 film, and I couldn't find any example of a documentary with the same name being released anywhere, it looks like this is that film. If you know differently, contact us.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. The bottom of our list is at number 20, our list, is The Spy Who Dumped Me, which made the charts with just $1.6 million at the box office. It's at $63 million and counting. My point is, if you know a film of in your country or in your territory or that has made more than $1.6 million worldwide, I'm looking at you, China, I'm looking at you, Korea, and other countries where we don't always get great box office information. If you know about a movie and it's not on our list, let us know because we'll want to include it next week or down the road.
And don't forget about India. Don't forget about India because there's lots of films there that we never hear about and we know they're making money.
Absolutely. And there are also films that don't make money. If you look at the North American charts, just a few weeks ago, people made a big fuss over this Kevin Spacey film that was kind of dumped onto one screen or three. And they said, "Ha, look how little money it made. Nobody cares about Kevin Spacey." It's true. He's a name and you should get some attention, even if your movie is dumped without any marketing. Nonetheless, it happens all the time. This week at the bottom of the list is Realms, a horror flick released by The Film Arcade, a company which has put out about 20 films, only one of which has ever grossed more than $1 million. And this movie came out on three screens. It made, over the weekend, $39 per screen. It made a total of $118 for the weekend.
On three screens.
That's person a day going to see one screening of the movie.
But we don't know. We have no idea how many showtimes it had. So
it's a contractual release. So yeah, it was probably dumped in somewhere in the middle of America, cheaper, without any marketing. And maybe they had one screen in a day, because you don't have to have a film show all day long like you did in the old days with physical prints. You can flip things up. So yeah, maybe it just had one screen in a day, but there was only one person at that screening, that we know. It's a horror flick set in Bangkok about bank robbers and their hostages naturally forced to take refuge in a haunted mansion.
That always happens.
And it stars Ryan Kelly, who was a supporting actor on the MTV hit show Teen Wolf, who's probably wondering when the Teen Wolf reunion show will happen.
That's kind of probably very true.
Yeah, poor guy. I mean, you know, he was on the show for the whole run of the series, almost every episode. So, you know, he could be a great actor. It's hard to break out and get better roles. So, you know, my sympathies go to him. Can't be a fun week. It is a fun week, however, for Jack Ma, isn't it?
Yeah, he's like, you know what? I've made enough money. I'm out of here. I'm dropping the mic on Alibaba.
That's right. He's stepping down. And how old is he? What is he doing? Why? Well, look, is there any reason?
He's over the hill, down the other side, and right up the other mountain. You know, he's just so old. He's 54. I mean, you know, stick a fork in him. He's done.
54 is like the new 30.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's good, because I'm almost 50. Yeah.
So he feels like he's done everything he can. He says, I'm probably a better teacher than running a business, which means he's a hell of a good teacher. And there seems to be no power player. He just decided to do it, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, he's just, you know, like, much like Bill Gates, he's stepping aside to get into philanthropy and into teachings. Specifically, he will be getting into educational philanthropy.
Yeah, and Wanda is looking to step aside too, aren't they?
They're kind of like, hey, you know, we need more money now back in China because we're under a microscope, so maybe we can kind of unload some of that AMC company that we own in the United States, maybe?
They're looking to offload hundreds of millions of dollars of their stake. They have a 60% stake in AMC, and in fact, AMC may borrow funds in order to claim that stock and keep it in-house. So they may borrow against it and have the stock and then pay off the debt. This seems a sad, confusing move to me. I mean, it seems like a very good investment.
Well, it is. The problem that they're having, of course, is all Chinese-related. It's all related to the government and the fact that Wanda kind of stuck its head up above the parapet a little bit too high.
But it's a shame they can't offload bad investments or things that aren't as promising or don't seem like good, solid, long-term investments, which is what I think AMC is. A lot of people say, oh, it's boring distribution. It's a mature industry. All you ever got to do is invest more money in equipment and entertainment and the environment.
You mean exhibition, not distribution.
Exhibition. I beg you. I always say that wrong. Yeah. So they think it's a boring, mature industry. I'm like, yeah, it's a good, solid, safe industry that you've got decades of track record to know you're going to make coin on it as long as you keep expenses within certain bounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the Warren Buffett thing.
But everybody thinks that
and you know
that Netflix is going to kill movie theaters. That's really what everybody believes.
I don't. Do you?
No, I don't at all. I'm kind of no. I'm teeing you up. Actually, is what?
Well, Netflix is another TV channel, and just like HBO, they do some great stuff, and it's great, but it doesn't make me not want to go to the movies.
You know, Venice thinks they do good stuff too. The Venice Film Festival.
What happened there?
Well, at the Venice Film Festival, Alfonso Cuarón, an award-winning filmmaker, he won the best film with a film called Roma. It was shot in black and white. It was a film that takes place in Mexico. It won the Golden Lion there in Venice, yeah. And it was already considered a kind of a leading contender for that honor, even before it opened. It's about a housekeeper and, of course, the rich family that employs her in Mexico City during the 1970s, so kind of a childhood throwback for Mr. Cuarón. The Silver Lion went to the Odiard, Jacques Odiard, for Sisters Brothers, and that stars Joaquin Phoenix and John C. Reilly, and this is an Old West movie. And the Silver Lion Grand Jury Prize went to our friend Yorgos Lanthimos from Greece for The Favorite, also an English language movie for him. So both Odiard and Lanthimos made English language movies.
Yeah, and The Favorite sounds like it's a lot of fun and could be a commercial breakthrough in the art house level for Lanthimos. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It sounds like a lot of fun. And The Sisters Brothers, it seems to have an early 70s funky vibe, sort of, you know, a McCabe and Mrs. Miller vibe, quirky, offbeat. I'm excited, but I loved the book. The book is so good, so funny. I'm hoping he captured the spirit of the book, but I'm a little wary of it, you know, because I liked the book so much. But certainly, when they say it's a quirky, weird film, then okay, he's getting closer to the book because it is not a traditional Western.
Well, and the final film I'll mention here is the one, the award that went to Best Screenplay for Joel and Ethan Coen's The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And you might be wondering, okay, he got into this by mentioning Netflix? What the heck is going on? Why did he mention Netflix and then went right into the Venice Film Festival? Well, Roma and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs are both Netflix titles. Venice said, unlike Cannes, we will let Netflix titles into the festival. And guess what? Roma won, and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs won an important award for a screenplay.
Well, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs sounds very problematic. Most of the reviews said, hey, it's a collection of shorts that's all held together. It was meant to be a six-part series, and now they've put it together in a film. Some are better than others, as one would expect. It sounds like it will probably play well on TV, watching it on Netflix in your home. You might just stop after one or two and then watch, you know, the rest later. Roma, however, sounds like it deserves to be seen on the big screen. Gorgeous cinematography. And it seems like Netflix is going to say, you know what, we might not mind winning an Oscar, at least getting nominated. So this may see a real theatrical release, not just we'll put it on one screen and then show it on TV, but an actual theatrical release where they try to distribute it and they try and get it seen and noticed by critics and develop money. And maybe they'll realize, you know what, there's more money to be made that way too.
Well,
they want this film to be really, really popular.
Well, yes, and I can tell you that John Fithian, the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, was in Toronto at the Toronto International Film Festival, I believe it was on Friday, saying, hey, you know what, Netflix, we're more than happy to have your film show in our theaters. We just have to figure out a good way for it to be successful for both of us.
Well, it's called windowing. We know the way. You know, if it's a big movie and you want people to see it in a theater, you can't release it on TV at the same time. If you do, you're going to limit your theatrical potential. That's fine. You got an art house film that's never going to go wide, or you've got a tiny little documentary. Okay, and you're not going to play in every territory in the country. So, you know, maybe a day and date thing makes sense, or maybe you want to make people feel a little special when they go to the theater, knowing it's not available anywhere else for at least a month.
Right.
But you got a movie, you think you can touch a popular nerve, Y Tu Mama Tambien, that made a lot of money at the movie theaters, not blockbuster money, but it also made that film immensely more valuable than if it had just played on Mexican TV.
And if you read immensely my story with Ellis Jacob in Celluloid Junkie, that's exactly what he talks about, that theatrical window kind of lends some cachet to a film and can help it make more money in ancillary markets. Now, certainly, you know, Netflix would love to not only win in Venice, but at the Academy Awards. Those films will have to play in theaters for them to be eligible. And they will. They'll play in a few theaters here in North America. But
a real campaign needs a real exhibition.
Right, correct. And I can tell you one award that even if those films kind of do break out on, like Roma, if it breaks out on the during the awards season, one category it will not win, hands down, I know this for sure, is the popular film category, best popular film. I know it won't win.
How can you be so confident? How can you be so sure?
Because that is a brand new category, and the Academy has decided, yeah, we're not going to do that. Yeah, we thought about it. We thought about it for half a second after we announced it, and everybody basically threw rotten eggs at us and decided, let's not do this.
That's actually not what they said.
Okay, fine. It's not what they said, but it sounded good, right? I mean,
right. It's not true. What they said was, we're going to look at it further. They realized they had rushed it, that the details were not in place. People didn't know what to do. Oscar campaigns have already been begun. PR firms have been hired. They start mapping out their strategy at the beginning of the year, and now it's the fall season, and they still don't even know what rules they're going to impose, that they realize we can't do this for the 2019 Oscars. they still insist they're looking at it and they may go forward for 2020, but they're putting it on pause to study the issue further. I still think it's so asinine and everybody hated it so much, it won't happen. But here's what, what's his name? John Bailey? Tom Bailey?
Oh, the cinematographer who now runs the, well, not runs, but he's the head of the board, John Bailey.
I know his name is Bailey. I want to say George Bailey because of, Bailey. You know, It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, no,
I saw him at the AIMA and I just a couple weeks ago, and I was this close to, he was there the whole weekend, and I really wanted to go up to him and say, what were you guys thinking? And I held back. I didn't do it.
Well, here's what he said. He said, I wasn't, very defensively, I would add, I wasn't expecting that kind of knee-jerk reaction largely from journalists. I don't know why that happened, because these are the same people who have also criticized the Academy for being quote-unquote irrelevant and not actually addressing the taste of people that go to the movies. The same people who have criticized us for irrelevance and elitism now suddenly were the guardians of the gate talking about the boulderization of the Oscars. And, you know, he says, quote, it didn't meet with universal disdain, but it's always the naysayers who like to jump on first, end quote. To which I say, okay, it got near universal disdain, perhaps not complete, but near universal disdain. And he's wrong when people say, hey, it's a shame the best picture doesn't go to sometimes to films that are really popular in recent years, like Mad Max Fury Road, The Dark Knight doesn't even get nominated, animated films are ghettoized into a different category. The solution is not to create a runner-up category that says, well, you'll never win the big prize, but we'll give you this consolation prize. So there's not a contradiction when journalists and people said, hey, we'd love to see these great popular films nominated for Best Picture and maybe win. And the answer is not, well, we'll just shove you in a corner. That's what they did with animated films. That's what they're trying to do with popular films. And you know what? If Black Panther can't get a nomination and win, then okay. But, you know, your membership is changing. Historically, the Oscars have often gone every few years to a really big popular film. It's just in the last 5-8 years, the Academy has not, I mean, the Academy, the movie studios have not been making really good popular films. They're just not that good. I'm not shocked that The Avengers, Age of Ultron, was not nominated for Best Picture. It shouldn't have been.
That's, you're right. But just the fact that like of all the movies you could have picked, that's the one you went for.
Yes. Well, because that's a big one. There are films worthy of being nominated and winning Best Picture that have been ignored. Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, that was one of the best reviewed movies in ages. The Dark Knight, Beauty and the Beast got a nomination.
It did.
Half of the first 10 Pixar films deserved to be nominated and or win. Mad Max Fury Road, the solution is not to create a new consolation prize. But here's what I thought was interesting. Some of the facts that they gave out made no sense to me. They say, for example, that 340 films played a one-week run in L.A. and qualified for Best Picture. 340 films qualified for, you know, to be up for Best Picture. That can't possibly be true.
There's got to be more than that.
In New York City, I know that about 900 to 1,000 films play at least a one-week commercial run in New York City. That's what happened last year and the year before. There's no way L.A. has a third of the number of movies being released. I'm not sure what they were quoting or what they were talking about, but that's what they said. And they further said that when they were looking at how many films would qualify for this popular Oscar award, they were looking at things like, well, how wide did they open? That was one of the criteria.
The problem, right? They had no criteria.
Right. Well, they were still debating it, and that's what they were talking about this later meeting. And one of the criteria they used, they didn't detail it, but they said, looking at what were wide releases, they decided only 70 films opened wide, their definition of wide, which I guess means like 3,000 screens or something, or 3,500 screens, because 70 movies is just about one a week. That's not a lot. I guess that's wide now, but they didn't detail what that was. So how they came up with 340 films, I don't understand. How they came up with just 70 films opening wide, I don't understand. However, I don't think they should do it, but I think screen count was a pretty smart way of deciding what's a popular film. You know, budget, you can never know. So you can't possibly use that as your metric. And box office gross doesn't quite make sense. I think going wide is a pretty good idea.
Well, that was, you know, when it was first announced, that's what everybody said. Look, the only way they're going to be able to do this is by distribution. You know, how wide did it get distributed?
I guess they were talking about box, you know, big budget movies versus little movies. You know, should My Big Fat Greek Wedding be up against, you know, a $100, $200 million movie? Well, they're both popular, so I guess why not?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day,
I guess that probably,
Crazy Rich Asians probably could win this category.
No, because it's not wide enough. Crazy Rich Asians is nowhere near their category of wide release.
No, all right.
I can't imagine, not when only 70 films qualify. How many screens is it on right now?
I don't know. I'd have to go check.
Right now, it's on 3,000. Oh, I'm sorry. It's on 3,800 screens. So I guess that would be fair.
Yes.
But again, you've got The Nun, Crazy Rich Asians. Peppermint was on 2,980 screens. So maybe that doesn't make the cut. But it just seems weird to me that maybe 3,000 screens is their standard. We'd have to go through an entire year's list to see what qualifies as a 3,000 screen movie. But
I suggest we not do that right now.
Not right now, not live on the air?
No.
Well, let's get Book Filter then.
Yes, you know, Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And, you know, every week you go through all of the book releases over there at Book Filter and you kind of whittle them down to the books that we should be paying attention to as readers. But here on Showbiz Sandbox, you kind of bring a title or two each week that's ready for its close-up, that's ready for an adaptation, either for television or film. And this week I realized at the head of the show that you said that this book was hot off the presses. And anybody that's read this book, and you very well may have read this book if you live in North America or specifically the United States, and you went to elementary school, you probably have read Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes.
And certainly come
and the hot off the presses will then make sense to you.
That's right. This book came out 75 years ago. It's a classic historical novel for kids, but it can be read and enjoyed by anyone. It's about a 14-year-old boy who gets caught up in the events leading to the American Revolution. I think he's a blacksmith and he injures his hand.
That's right.
And so he ends up working for people, and there's John Adams, there's this person. And suddenly he's around all these revolutionary figures and he gets swept up in the Boston Tea Party, in the shots fired at Lexington, and it leads up to the American Revolution. It doesn't actually go all the way through the revolution, but it sort of shows what led to the American Revolution. And it's a 75-year-old book, and it's already been made into a movie.
That's
so
true.
What the heck? But they made it a movie in 1957 by Disney, and it's not good.
No.
So frankly, this is a classic novel. They should revisit this one. This needs to be made again. It could be a TV series. It might be a movie. I mean, a mini series. But, you know, there's a curse on projects made about the American Revolution. They're almost never successful. Now with Hamilton, maybe that bugaboo has gone away, and I think Johnny Tremaine is ripe for remake.
Yeah, you know, Johnny Tremaine.
And I guess Disney is the one to do it. I'm sorry, but I bet Disney is the one to do it because they must own the rights to it.
I was going to say that, yes. Johnny Tremaine was a blacksmith, and the reason I mentioned the hot off the presses thing is he burned his hand on silver, silver poured on his hand, and he actually he had to have his hand replaced because of that burn.
Mm-hmm. They gave him a fake hand?
Yeah, I think it
a
was
a false hand?
I think it was made out of metal, in fact.
Oh, they chopped off his whole hand?
I
really?
I think so. Maybe I'm wrong. I have to go back and it hasn't been 75 years.
I think he cured his hand.
But,
I don't think they chopped it off, but maybe.
Yeah,
I don't think they gave him a fake hand. Maybe. I don't know. It's been a long time since I've read it.
I don't know.
But when you read it as a kid, it was probably in paperback, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it was for school. It was absolutely for school. And I tried to read it to my kids, but I think I tried a little too early because they were like, what are all these big words? So I think right now would be the time, you know, 13, 11 years old. They'd probably like it right about now.
It's certainly good for them now. And you'll, again, probably read it in paperback?
Yes, I'd give it to them in paperback. Now, why are you mentioning this? The 75th anniversary edition is being published. Okay, I get it.
Well, that's true, but also Penguin Random House has just made a new deal with libraries.
Oh.
They've changed their standards on ebooks. Every publisher has their own standard of what ebooks they sell to libraries, how much they charge, and how they figure out what to do. Because technically, if you give them one digital copy of a book, they could perhaps loan it out to the entire world. You know, you got a digital copy, you can make copies of it and loan it to the world. That's not the deal, of course. And so every publisher has different standards. There was a big fracas just a few weeks ago when Tor, that's the sci-fi imprint at Macmillan, decided to have a four-month embargo. They felt ebooks were cutting into their sales, ebooks at libraries. And so they said, we're not going to sell them to you for 4 months after a book comes out. So if a book comes out in September, you're going to have to wait till next January before we'll give you an ebook version for loaning out to readers at libraries. Penguin Random House has now changed their rules, but it's actually in the better direction. What Penguin Random House was saying, we'll sell you an ebook, but we're going to charge you like $80. Your ebook's going to cost you $80, and you can keep it forever, loan it out forever, only one at a time, but you can use it forever. Now they're saying, all right, we've listened to you. We're going to sell you ebooks. We're going to make them much lower in price, but within 6 months or a year or 2 years, you won't be able to loan it out anymore. So you'll have a limited amount of time where you can loan it out. And libraries say that's great because you know what? We need like 50 copies of books or 100 copies of books when the new John Grisham comes out or the new Stephen King or the new Karen Slaughter. But 6 months later, we don't need those copies. Most of them just sit there. They end up selling most of those hardcovers or paperbacks. But in ebooks, they can't sell them. There's nothing they can do with them. And, you know, 6 months after a book comes out, for 99% of them, they don't need all those extra copies. So they're happy about this change. So at least some publishers are listening to librarians.
So they tried to go the videotape route. Remember when Blockbuster was around, they'd need to order,
$80, $90
right.
VHS tape. Yeah.
They called that priced for rental. Okay, that's what that was called. It would be, you know, like when Miller's Crossing, the Coen Brothers movie, was released. I wanted to go get it. It was $99. I thought, I'm not paying $99 for a videotape. I'm sorry.
And then a year later, they would mark it down.
Price would sell off.
Or they would sell their used copies off because they would need 20 copies when the movie came out. But then rentals stopped after 6 months for most movies, and they say, all right, let's get rid of 18 of these.
Right.
We'll keep two on the shelf. Well, you know, used DVDs, used VHS is a big market. So are used books. And there's a used bookstore in Lakeland, Florida that's very popular. I've been there myself. And there was an interesting little tidbit in a story about this used bookstore. And it said that they saw all they carry are paperbacks. No hardcover. None. Zero. Zip. It's only paperbacks. That's all they've ever dealt in. And they never give you money. They just give you store credit. So it's if you bring in your old paperbacks, you get store credit. And then if you buy something straight out, you give them cash. They've been around for years, and they noticed an interesting thing, because we've been talking about ebooks versus paperback versus hardcover. They said about 3-4 years ago, the bottom fell out of ebook out of paperbacks. That's when ebooks were really popular. They said they didn't even know if they'd stay in business. Ebook paperback sales just collapsed. Nobody was buying paperbacks. Why? Because there were cheap copies available as ebooks. And then when publishers raised their prices again, suddenly the store saw paperback sales start to trend back up again, and now they're surviving, and they hope to be around for years to come.
I wonder how many copies of Johnny Tremaine they're selling.
I bet you they have a few copies, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, I like hardcover books, and I like ebooks. I tend not to read paperbacks that often. More and more I'm reading ebooks. So buying a paperback book to me would, you know, I don't know if I'd do it.
Oh my God. I never buy hardcover. I hate holding them and carrying them around and lugging them around. You're in a car world. So you know, you can just, but especially a bigger book, there's not a chance in hell I'm reading a big book in hardcover. I'm reading Jill Lepore's New History of America. It's a one volume history of America called These Truths. It's 900 pages long. I don't want to lug that thing around. I love ebooks.
Well, that is a big book.
That is a big book, and it's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Law and Order, isn't done yet. The venerable TV franchise is getting another U.S. edition. NBC has put in motion a new drama, this time focused on hate crimes. Good idea. Yeah. That joins Law and Order Special Victims Unit, which is entering its 20th season, tying the show with the original Law and Order and Gunsmoke as the longest-running dramas in primetime history, at least here in the United States. As of this summer, the Law and Order franchise has delivered more than 1,100 original episodes, leaving other franchises like Star Trek in the dust. In a very different vein, Project Runway is being revived by Bravo, but not with Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn. They're jumping to Amazon to launch an entirely new fashion-centric show. I wonder if you can buy any of the products that there will be on that show on Amazon. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, what a shocker that would be. It's a big whoop for Law and Order, right? It's never gone away. It continues to set records. And I think hate crimes is a really smart focus for a new edition of Law and Order. You know, I'm sure they've covered them in other iterations, but I think that gives them a timely, interesting focus and perhaps a whole new wellspring of ideas to tackle. As for, I just want to know if John Munch is going to show up. That's all I care about.
Oh, what? Because he's been mentioned in every other Law and Order?
He's either appeared in at the least or at least been mentioned in every other Law and Order and all the Chicago shows too. But Dick Wolf, he's slowly becoming one of the I mean, he is one of the biggest of all time, but my God, he may end up with the record for like the most successful TV producer of all time. It's crazy how successful he's been. As for the, you know, Tim Gunn and Heidi Klum jumping to Amazon. Wow. You know,
yeah,
it's been a long time with Bravo, but they got a new idea. We don't know what it is yet. We'll have to see what it is.
Well, you know, there was some, I don't want to say controversy, but there was some discussion about whether hate crimes was, whether it should be tackled. You know, are they making light of it or trying to make hate crimes entertaining? Because, you know, they're complicated subjects, it's a complicated topic.
Do they make special sex crimes?
And that was the
entertaining?
Counter. That was the, yes, yeah. That was the counter.
Law and Order is not known for its light tone.
Yeah. Now, Eminem was so annoyed at the critical and commercial reaction to his somewhat mature and contemplative album, Recovery, that he got all Slim Shady on us and recorded a new album dissing, well, everyone who dissed his last album. He surprise dropped it, and unlike Nicki Minaj, it worked great. His album is debuting at the top of the Billboard charts with the equivalent of 360,000 albums sold, well past his 260,000 debut of Recovery. Angry M, as we will now call him, is also popular overseas. His album is debuting at number one in the United Kingdom, making it his ninth consecutive number one album and breaking a tie for the record he held with Led Zeppelin and ABBA. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. Artist releases album and it's a success. I know he's just a cranky old man saying, get off my lawn. I don't like these new rappers, but I, you know, he raps and I just love hearing him rap. He's so technically skilled and interesting that I enjoyed this new album, whereas most critics did not. I didn't love it. I didn't like the gay slur, but I can live with it. The funny thing was some of the people that he dissed, some of the young rappers coming up that he said, he doesn't like what they, one guy was like, oh my God, he was so delighted that Eminem even knew of him, much less mentioned him on the album. He said, this is literally the happiest day of my life. Eminem said my name. He was thrilled. So I thought that was kind of cool and funny. And in the UK, I immediately wondered, wait a second, Eminem's got 9 consecutive number one albums, and that breaks a tie with ABBA and Led Zeppelin. What about the Beatles?
Well, what about them?
Well, it turns out they had a streak of 8 number one albums.
Missed it by that much.
That much. What messed them up was their TV special. They lived a blessed life. Everything they did turned to gold. They appear on the BBC with their own show. They make movies. They're brilliant. I mean, Hard Day's Night, Help Not So Brilliant, but still beloved. Yellow Summer. Everything they did was great. But then they did a TV special at the holidays, Magical Mystery Tour. And it was so ramshackle, so self-indulgent, so hateful. Everybody just hated that TV show. They hated it. And that led to the album peaking at number 31. Magical Mystery Tour is a great album, and it only peaked at number 31 because the TV show was so awful, and that's what broke their streak. So, there you go.
Speaking of the United Kingdom, bookstores in the UK struggle with the same problem bookstores face all over the world. Amazon. Waterstones is the United Kingdom's biggest chain, and it has one solution and one solution only. Get bigger. First, they bought out Dillon's, the second largest bookstore chain in the UK. Then they bought out Otakars, or is it Otakars?
I don't know.
Yeah. Then they bought out the 8 stores of Books Etc. And now this week, they've purchased the venerable, quirky, beloved family-owned bookstore chain, Foyles. The retailer has, or rather had, just 7 stores, but they had personality and were seen as an important alternative to Waterstones. However, the family behind Foyles said they believed merging with Waterstones was the only way to survive. Waterstones insists that unlike those other takeovers, the Foyles stores will stay Foyles and maintain their own personalities and buyers. We shall see. Now, I know people will write in and say, it's Waterstones, not Waterstones. So,
but you couldn't help yourself. You just wanted to be British.
Yes. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I mean, Foyles is a venerable chain. Now, Waterstones did buy out Hatchards, which is a single store. I don't think they have more than one in London. I go there all the time. I love it. It's just 5 stores down from a Waterstones right next to Piccadilly Circus. And they have let Hatchards maintain its own identity. Presumably, they'll find there's more value in letting Foyles maintain a slightly different, quirky identity. And that will be best for everyone. So that's cool to see. And since they had a good track record with Hatchards, maybe they'll do the same for foils. But I have to say, they bought out the number two chain and then the number three chain and then a store with just eight stores. Now one with just seven. I mean, soon they're just going to buy my library of books. You know, all right, you've got a library of books. We're going to buy your books. they're getting down to one store chains. It's getting small.
They're going to sell you the shirt you're wearing.
Exactly.
You know, the UK actually has a history of this when it comes to pubs. You know, they were all, you know, family owned or one-offs.
Oh, yes. Now they're all chains, a lot of chains.
They're all chains, but they all look different. They all feel different. And I'm sure, you know, that's there are arguments that they don't look different. They don't look, they're not all unique. And that's been, I'm trying to remember the film. I think it was...
It's true, but they never were, frankly. Yeah. You know, it would be overstating the case to say that they were all lovable and eccentric and had some bizarre, unique... You know, they served beer and they had sports on the telly, you know.
And I can't remember the
Commitments? I don't know what movie.
No, I'm trying
of.
To think of it. It's the comedian one, the one with Simon Pegg in it. The comic, they did the cop one, and then they did the zombie one where they're always
Shaun of the Dead.
Shaun of
Hot
the Dead,
Buzz?
And I think they're running into. I think it's Shaun of the Dead actually, where they keep running into different pubs, and they all look exactly the same. They're all different, and they all look. And it's kind of one of those unspoken social comments on the state of pubs in the UK.
All the British got it, and the Americans were like, I don't get it.
Why do all these things, why do they keep running into these pubs? Like, is there a running joke? And the answer is yes.
Running joke. Speaking of bookstores, Barnes & Noble had a new report. Their sales fell again. And now they said they've fallen again for the first 6 months of 2018 compared to 1 year earlier. However, they do say if you look at it month by month, the news is getting better. Sales fell by like 8% and then 7%, then 5%, then 3%. And now if you look at August sales alone, sales are down compared to 1 year earlier, but only by 0.8%. So they are very hopeful that come September or October, they may actually improve over last year's sales. That'll certainly be good, but last year's sales weren't that good either. So it will be a modest uptick, and that's better than the trend they're going.
You know, somebody gave my youngest daughter a Barnes & Noble's gift card for her birthday, and my first comment was, better not hold on to that too long, kid. Now, usually the Emmys handed out off camera a week before the primetime awards are just an appetizer, or at best, an early indication of what might win big come Monday, September 17th, when awards like Best Comedy and Best Drama are handed out. But this year, the Creative Emmys, or the Creative Arts Emmys, made all sorts of news. Anthony Bourdain won all sorts of posthumous awards. Saturday Night Live continued its recent renaissance. History was made when people of color swept all four Best Guest Actor categories, and not one, no, not just one, not two, but three people became EGOTs when the live presentation of Jesus Christ Superstar won multiple awards, including Best Variety Series. Live.
Live.
Yes, live. Now, an EGOT, of course, is someone who has won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony, so kind of like us, Michael, you know.
Yeah.
Now, since Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice, and John Legend had already getting the Emmy as producers of the show allows them to join an exclusive club and be the answer to trivia questions for years to come. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal overall. It was a very interesting night of awards. A lot of cool things got it. And the counter argument to the increase of people of color and perhaps some women getting more representation is that Rick and Morty won Best Animated Show, which shows that people felt that the creator of Rick and Morty had made his amends and they weren't holding against him his acknowledgement of past sexual misconduct in terms of the quality of his show. Anthony Bourdain had never won before for writing, though he had won all sorts of awards. You know, you name it. He'd won a lot of cool things. And Craig Zidane was another sad moment because he also died after complications from shoulder surgery. And so the win for Jesus Christ Superstar went to him as well and was a little bit bittersweet for everyone involved. But Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice, John Legend, all EGOTs, but John Legend is the most impressive because he did it for the most diverse reasons. So that's pretty damn cool.
Two new musicals headed to Broadway this spring could not be starker in their differences. The first is Beetlejuice. Yes, that
Beetlejuice.
Yes, that one. A musical adaptation of the Michael Keaton movie that is currently playing in D.C. and directed by Alex Timbers. I thought it was opening in D.C. later this year. Oh, maybe. Maybe it's playing now. I don't know. He is also directing the upcoming musical Moulin Rouge, by the way, another movie-to-musical adaptation that has enjoyed promising reviews out of town. From the opposite end of the spectrum, the unknown off-Broadway musical Be More Chill is making the leap to Broadway after its young audiences turned it into a sold-out hit. I almost said solid hit. But it is a solid hit, and it is a sold-out hit, leaving producers with visions of Dear Evan Hansen dancing in their heads. Will this be a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, you're right, Sperling. Beetlejuice is playing starting next month, so it opens in October in D.C. So you are right yet again. So, you know, these are two very different projects. And, you know, when you're spending tens of millions of dollars on a Broadway musical, you want some known property. It's scary. They tend to want a big project that they know, okay, people have heard of it. To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway. All right, they've heard of that book and the Jeff Daniels, he's a star. It gives them a built-in audience. But you know what? The last four winners of Best Musical, and that's usually the best path to profitability, or at least the best guarantee, they were all far less obvious than something like Beetlejuice. They were The Band's Visit, Dear Evan Hansen, Hamilton, and Fun Home. That's a movie and two books, by the way, and an original property with Dear Evan Hansen. But those are far less big names that, you know, you had going on. I mean, Hamilton was a well-done biography, but that was far from a slam dunk. So you don't need to make a big show in order to have a big hit, but, you know, it doesn't hurt. So I think it doesn't mean these shows won't be hits. You don't need to win the Best Tony Musical in order to be a hit. You know, Waitress, you know, Wicked, you name it. There's tons of examples. But if you look at the last decade, a lot of the award has often gone to unknowns or shows based on relatively obscure properties. So you don't need to be Beetlejuice in order to win on Broadway.
Have you seen Be More Chill?
I have not, though I really think it's a mistake for them to rush it to Broadway. Just looking at it from afar, this show did not get that good reviews. Most of the critics were pretty timid on it. They're like, oh, you know, the kids loved it. You know, the teenagers loved it. It's literally what they were reporting as like kids in the audience. Like, I'm sick of Spring Awakening and Dear Evan Hansen. I love Be More Chill. They're crazy about it. It could have run for ages off Broadway and been done all over the country. Moving it to Broadway when you didn't have rave reviews from the critics and it's a pretty unknown property. Teenagers don't buy that many tickets on Broadway. It's true. They went to Dear Evan Hansen. It's true. Young people can be repeat theater goers, but theater is very expensive on Broadway and it tends to be a slightly older crowd, and you really don't want to rush a show to Broadway when it doesn't have good reviews. To me, when it's a small property, mixed reviews at best, that seems really iffy. I would not have done it. But of course, I'd love to see it first, but just from afar, not a good call.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Well, this week's story, how will it affect you? Well, I don't know. Maybe some of the shows on CBS that you're watching might change over the next couple of years, because Les Moonves, the chairman and CEO of CBS, is out after six more women came forward detailing sexual misconduct, physical assault, harassment, and retaliation. Others have called for Moonves' golden parachute and his contract to be withdrawn. I guess that actually might happen if the report, and they have an independent report being done right now, and if that report comes back to CBS and is not good for Moonves, well, he might not get anything.
Bollocks, I don't believe you. That's not true. I think they're setting it up. I mean, that's the report we have today.
Yeah, I mean, Moonves, you and I both agree on that. We say yes.
Yeah. So that's not going to happen. Yeah. They're doing everything they can to make sure they can give him his money and make him go away without a drawn-out lawsuit or court battle. And they don't want people to know what they're paying him because they know it's going to be embarrassing. Moonves, of course, says these are untrue allegations. Apparently, the dozen and counting women are all liars, I guess. He says some of them were consensual and the others are just lying. Which is a remarkable idea to have in your head. By the way, his wife, Julie Chen, did not show up on The Talk today. She's a big part of CBS. She's on The Talk. She's also on Big Brother as a host of that show. She just did not come up on the air today. She just skipped the season premiere of The Talk. Whether she's going to want to be in the public eye, how she's going to want to deal with that, her career should not be derailed because of him. But it's certainly awkward when you are on live television and dealing with these issues and talking about them to have your husband be at the center of it when he's at the network you're working at. So that's complicated for her. Your sympathies certainly go with her. But again, the CBS has set this up. They've said already today they will not release the final findings of the investigation. They are going to go private on what they do with Les Moonves. They loudly said, we're not giving him any money now, but they have set aside $120 million, which they may have to pay out to him. And they have already made clear they don't want to tell us what they ultimately do. Whatever they deal with Les Moonves, they want to keep it confidential. He wants to keep it confidential because they don't want people yelling at them for giving him $100 million or $80 million or $20 million or $20. That's what some people say. Why are you giving him any money at all? You're firing him for abusing his position. Why should he get a big golden parachute? The last 2 years alone, Les Moonves was paid $140 million.
Do you think that it will eventually just kind of people forget that CBS is doing that? Or do you think it will kind of continue to come up and eventually CBS will have to cave and say, well, OK, we'll make the report public and we'll also let you know what we paid him out on?
Sadly, people have very short-term memories, and you're going to be looking for something to happen that doesn't have to happen in public. So it could take 6 months. It could take a year. You can keep asking the question, but eventually you're going to get bored and move on, and it's going to be really hard to pay attention and know when this happened because it's all going to be done privately. Obviously, somebody can leak it. That info can get out. It's going to be very hard for them to keep it quiet, but they're sure as heck going to try.
Well, and there's a bit of palace intrigue going on as well, because as part of his deal to step down, and he is stepping down, there is a difference between stepping down and being fired, as we all know. But
right, for legal reasons and what you have to pay out. Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
The settlement is basically allowing six board members to be canned. And then they just happen to be the six board members that Sherry Redstone of National Amusements, which owns both Viacom and CBS. She does not get along with those six board members. They're now out. National Amusements.
They were in his camp. They were voting to keep CBS separate from Viacom.
Correct. And that starting in May, Viacom said, hey, you know, this whole Paramount thing, we need money. Okay. Viacom needs money. And CBS, you have money. CBS, you used to be a part of us. In the 2000s, we kind of split the companies into two separate public companies. And we now want to merge them again so that, well, your windfall, your cash cows can help pay for Viacom. And Les Moonves said, well, I can't allow that because, you know, I have a fiduciary responsibility not to take on a cancer known as Viacom. So he sued National Amusements and Sherry Redstone. And Sherry Redstone was none too happy about it. And, well, now she basically has been able to stock the board in her favor. National Amusements has agreed as part of this settlement, as part of Les Moonves stepping down, that National Amusements would not seek to merge Viacom and CBS for at least 2 years. What does that mean? That means in 2 years, they'll probably try and merge them again. As well,
they're waiting 2 years.
Well, yes, that was part of the deal. Another part of the deal, okay.
So why would they delay for 2 years when the guy who was blocking them is out? I'm confused. I missed that detail that the merger is going to be delayed for 2 years. Doesn't that create all sorts of trouble for Viacom?
They
want to merge.
They want to merge, but basically that was the deal that was cut. Otherwise, Les Moonves would have had to have been
fired. Why would he have any power to make that happen? When it was very up in the air whether the merger would happen or not, why would his being ousted and all his members being replaced on the board mean, okay, we won't merge. We'll wait a couple years.
Well, that's the settlement that was struck. That's what was, you know, that was the settlement. That, you know, those board members would resign. They would be replaced by other board members. I mean, Doug Morris, the head of Sony Music, was one of the board members that stepped down along with Les Moonves.
Everybody's always everybody else's friend. Who cares?
Right.
Yeah.
So one of the other things is that the CBS reversed its decision to try and give National Amusements or allow National Amusements no more than 20% of the voting stock. So that was part of the issue there was that
So they have to wait 2 years and then they merge.
Well, yes. However, one of the other issues is that National Amusements could block any deal that would have given them less than 30% of the voting stock. So
that's pretty typical, isn't it?
That's pretty typical. And they were, so even if the deal was a great deal, National Amusements would have said, well, this is a great deal. It's going to benefit us, but not in the long run because we'll have less than 30% of the voting stock. We're not going to vote for it, and we can kill it.
Well, they can block somebody else from taking over CBS.
Correct.
Right. So, of course they can. Of course they can. They have all the board members. They have all the majority of the stock. Yeah.
Well, however, now they have said in this settlement that they will not block any deal in good faith. So at least that's what they've said.
Why would they cave on all those things because he was found guilty of sexual misconduct and had to leave? Why would that force them to give up?
Well,
say, well, maybe you can merge with someone else, and we definitely won't merge with you for 2 years because Les Moonves was shamed out of his job. Why wouldn't they be in a stronger position than ever? Why would they be in a weaker position because Les Moonves was shamed out of his job?
Because the board had already said you do not have a majority of the voting stock of CBS anymore, and we're not going to allow you to have a majority of the voting stock of CBS anymore, so you can't force a merger.
They didn't have it.
They did. They were diluting the stock, basically.
The board did.
Yes.
But that was going to court. They were in court suing over all.
Correct. Correct.
So again, why would National Amusements cave when they are in court fighting this and the guy leading the opposite charge has just been shamed out of his job? Why would they say, okay, never mind about the lawsuit? Are they dropping it?
Yes, the lawsuit is dropped.
Why would their main opponent, having to leave the battlefield, make them say, okay, we won't fight anymore?
Well, because he's leaving the battlefield under these conditions. And that part of that is the...
He has to leave the job. He has to leave. He's not in charge. He doesn't get to say, oh, okay, I'll leave. It's like, he was out. That was not up for debate anymore. What was up for debate is how much money they pay him, which they're going to do anyway. But he's in a weakened position.
He was in a weakened position. However, the board was still the board, and
the board was still backing him. They'd already said he had to leave.
As part of this settlement of this lawsuit, those board members are stepping aside. That is what is happening here.
There's more fallout, of course, at CBS because of this. Eventually, we assume Sheree Redstone will take over, right?
Well, at some point, yeah, I think.
Right. At least, she already has. The earliest 2 years.
She already has.
But no, they can't do the merger for 2 years then.
Right, correct.
Right. But most of the top execs at CBS, he's been there for decades.
Correct.
They've all been either hired by him, virtually all of them, or if they're not, they're certainly deeply linked to Les Moonves.
Correct.
Is there going to be a massive culling of top execs at CBS? I mean, this network has been hugely successful amidst an environment of sexual misconduct, to say the very least. I mean, I would expect Jeff Fager of 60 Minutes to be watching his back. Maybe he won't have a job.
Yes.
But are they going to call all these executives when CBS has been firing on all cylinders and making a lot of money for everyone?
Well, I think what's going to happen is they're going to find a new chairman and CEO, and that person will come in and take a look around.
I'm available.
Yeah, and they're going to take a look around, and they're going to say, hey, Executive A, you have been in charge of the following hit TV shows like, Big Bang Theory and 2.5 Men. Why don't you stick around a while?
Everybody always looks at the weaker ones. My question is, because these people were loyal and linked to Les Moonves, do you think beside their job performance, are they going to say, let's clean house here?
No, I don't think
so. Not because of the sexual misconduct, but just to say, these people are all against us. They're all poisoned against us. They don't like us. They don't want us in charge. They're unhappy. They're just going to say, all right, business as usual. Keep going forward.
Yes, because I think the fact that Les Moonves, you know, a lot of times when this, you know, as we've seen over the past year, what will happen is it's all settled very quickly. You know, the allegations come out and then it's over within a month. This was being dragged out. And I think those executives they're just happy it's over. And that they can now move forward. So as much as, yes, they may have been hired by Les Moonves, they all knew Les Moonves was a dead man walking.
Yeah, it's going to be very hard to know what the settlement is, but people will pay attention, hopefully. Certainly Amy Powell, she was kicked out by Paramount, and now she has reached a multi-million dollar settlement over her firing after alleged racially insensitive comments. She says, I didn't make racially insensitive comments, but they have come to an agreement, and she has settled up and been paid whatever she felt she was deserved and was happy to accept. So these things are hard to follow. But people will want to know what happened with Les Moonves and CBS. One other fallout is in Toronto. Film buyers, apparently, are a lot more focused on morality clauses.
Yes,
because of Louis C.K. and other things. But I find that bizarre. Don't they always have morality clauses?
Yeah, but they're what's new? They're not tight to that. In other words, the morality clause is, you know, they're certainly a lot stronger now. And and in a way that they can recoup their money directly from the purchase or back out of the purchase.
Mm-hmm. Well, this story in the Hollywood Reporter about film buyers focusing on morality clauses was all from the point of view of acquisitions execs. And in my mind, I want a morality clause if I'm a filmmaker, because I'm immediately thinking about Harvey Weinstein or some other of these people in charge of acquisitions who maybe my movie's going to get stranded and lost because of their morality issues. So I'm shocked that it's only one way.
So basically what you're saying is me? No, you two.
Me too, you too, exactly. Because, and let's be clear, it's not just the TV industry, it's not just the film industry, it's all throughout society, of course, but also the music industry. There's a new book by Dorothy Carvello. She was an exec at Atlantic Records in the 1970s, and she has a story to tell about what work was like for her, and it's pretty ugly.
Well, you know, I can't imagine during the 70s, that, I mean, there were no drugs back in the 70s, so that wasn't a problem. And, you know, women pretty much owned the workforce back then. They weren't just getting in. They had been there for hundreds of years. Yeah, no. So I can't imagine that she had any problems whatsoever as a music executive in the 1970s.
Yeah, she said basically it was, quote, like a porn movie.
Yeah.
And she is not the star of that film when she says that. The memoir is called Anything for a Hit, and it talks about the toxic work environment and how the women who did make it in there had to be really tough and were as suspicious of each other as any other man. So, you know, it's a sad tale in certain ways. There was fun had, but fun always at the expense of someone else, and she details it all. So, you know, there's a reckoning still to come in the music industry, like we're just starting to see in film and theater and television.
Well, you know, you're saying that Dorothy Carvello is telling a sad tale, and unfortunately it is time for our obituary section. And we have a few sad tales here, specifically Mac Miller, a hip-hop rapper, died at the age of 26 of a drug overdose.
Yes, it's very sad. You know, what I would say is he didn't die by ODing. He was killed by addiction.
Yes.
You know, they talk about, when you talk about suicide, they don't want you to say, this is not Mac Miller. He didn't commit suicide as such. There's no sense that he intentionally ODed, but he did OD. And they say, don't say people committed suicide. Say they died by suicide. Died of mental illness, or in this case, addiction, because that's what did it. He was trying to get better. He fought it for years. He was very public about it. Ariana Grande was his girlfriend for a while. She finally broke up with him because she said, I can't help someone who won't help himself, and I can't be responsible for somebody who's, you know, I can't make him healthy. And she gave up, but she still was his friend and cared about him and has talked about him. It's obviously a very painful time, but he had a new album out. He was set to go on tour, and it just got the better of him. An addiction killed him. You know, it's like, a person did drugs and he OD'd. It's like, no, he was killed by an illness, the illness of addiction.
And you might remember back in January, Dolores O'Riordan of the Cranberries died. Turns out she was young. She was like in her 40s. She died accidentally she drowned after heavy drinking.
That's right. A tragic accident. You know, it happens. You fall into a coma, or you do drugs, this or that, or you drink too much alcohol, and then unintentionally you choke on your own vomit, you fall down in the bathtub and drown. I mean, it's just very sad and awful. I don't know what her health issues were in terms of addiction, whether that was a general problem, but very sad to hear. It's a lot easier to deal with someone when they die and they're, 91 years old. That's Bill Daly. And if you're an American sitcom fan, you will recognize Bill Daly from two TV shows. One of them is I Dream of Jeannie, a moronic TV show that was never a big hit on the air, but a massive success in reruns. And the other show, he was the neighbor, the airline pilot, Howard Borden, on The Bob Newhart Show, one of the best sitcoms of all time.
Well, and then of course...
Do you recognize Bill Daly?
Of course I do.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He's a very affable guy, and that was a sweet thing. And I just want to make one more point about I Dream of Jeannie. It was the first show that in reruns would beat network shows. They were airing in prime time. This was back in the day before networks, and people said, hey, don't run those shows in prime time. In reruns, it was starting to beat network TV shows. So it's really this dumb, silly show about a guy with a genie became super popular in reruns. That's why you might know it, even though it was never a big, big hit back in the day.
Well, and of course, finally and lastly, Burt Reynolds died at the age of 82. Actor Burt Reynolds. This was probably the big star passing away of the week.
Right, but we don't want to be like the Oscars where you get more applause, see who gets more applause. No. You know? But yeah, he's a classic Hollywood movie star. And he was that even in the cutting edge decade of the 70s. The 70s was where you had Al Pacino and Dustin Hoffman reinventing the idea of the movie star, and movies themselves were quirky and strange. Not Burt Reynolds. He was making Smokey and the Bandit, Cannonball Run. You know, he liked fun movies. Fun guy, great personality, terrible at picking projects. Terrible.
Yes.
This man did not manage his career well.
No, think about it. This is just a list of some of the roles Burt Reynolds turned down after he, you know, after Deliverance, his big breakout movie, and then The Longest Yard. He was offered James Bond, turned it down. A little a role of Han Solo, turned it down, went to Harrison Ford instead. He was offered the role of Michael Corleone in The Godfather, turned that down. He was offered the role of Richard Gere, the Richard Gere role in Pretty Woman. And then two of Jack Nicholson's probably most well-known roles, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Terms of Endearment, he turned both of those down. He was offered the Bruce Willis role in Die Hard, and he turned down Boogie Nights 7 times. It was the only role he was nominated for an Academy Award for.
Yeah, the first two I'm not sure about. I think James Bond and Han Solo he has claimed, but I'm not sure that they hold water. I think for The Godfather, Brando said he wouldn't do it if they hired Burt Reynolds. But the others are pretty strongly documented, I think. Certainly Terms of Endearment was his big regret. He thought, oh my God, why did I do this? Well, that was the biggest mistake of his career. But, you know, he did make good movies. My favorite of his is Best Friends with Goldie Hawn. It's a really charming little movie where they're going to visit their in-laws, his parents and then her parents. It's a sweet movie. It's not a masterpiece, but it's fun. Certainly Boogie Nights is a great movie. And the witless Cannonball Run movies, they gave outtakes a bad name. You know, they had those outtakes at the end of the movie. And yes. You're like, that's kind of funny. And then they beat it to death, and then everybody else did. And you're just like, yeah, you know what? There's a reason they're outtakes. And he also did the Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater in Jupiter, Florida, which is dinner theater, a horrific idea in general, right in my hometown, right near me where I lived in South Florida. So that always loomed large in my imagination. But he did win an Emmy for the sitcom Evening Shade. So he had a great late career resurgence. People really appreciated who he was and his fun personality. He was on The Tonight Show a gazillion times. He was the first non-comic to guest host The Tonight Show. So, you know, he posed nude for Cosmo. He was on the cover of Playboy. And he said, you know what? Don't feel sorry for me. Nobody had more fun than I did.
Yeah. You know, did you ever interview him?
No, our friend Jeff Boucher did.
Yeah.
He interviewed all the guys on Deliverance, I believe. But yeah, no, he interviewed him. I never spoke to him.
Yeah, I met him late in his career in the 2000s on a movie called Driven that Sylvester Stallone. Yeah, Sylvester Stallone was making, and it was an interesting talk. I mean, there's nothing bad to say, but you know, as far as outtakes go, of course, you know, we don't have any because we're just so perfect.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, big star, by the way, 5 years in a row, he was the top box office draw in North America from 1978 to 1982. Very few people can ever say they were that for that stretch of time. Bing Crosby back in the 40s is one that, you know, you think of. That is a very difficult thing to pull off.
Well, in the world of podcasts, we can say that. Which is why,
yeah, absolutely. We should merge with another podcast. We should buy, you know, if Waterstones can buy out all these other chains, why don't we buy out This American Life? I don't understand.
Yes,
hostile takeover.
Well, which is why you should subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can subscribe to us, rate and review us. It does help us out. When you do, it helps other people find the show as well. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have a website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's mostnunsareverynice.com.
Oh, I see.
Just letting you know.
Okay.
Just letting you know. They're not usually like that. They're not usually that scary.
Okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.